This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The holidays are here, and with Thanksgiving in the rearview mirror, that means holiday shopping. But holidays aren't just about shopping. Giving Tuesday is a day where people stop and focus on generosity. And we're joined now by two Central Floridians who give back. Beth Hobart is a realtor, and she heads up the Quest Adopt-A-Home Holiday Party. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Avni Desai is an IT executive who works to build a sense of generosity in her children by involving them in volunteering and charitable causes. Avni, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Beth, let's start with you. Tell me about the Adopt-A-Home Holiday Party. What is it? What got you started on this 15 years ago, right?
Yeah, just about now. I used to be a board member for Quest Incorporated. They've been around for over 50 years helping disabled people in the community, from kids to adults with varying disabilities, autism, Down syndrome, you know, all different types. Through my volunteering, I learned about the Quest Adopt-A-Home, and it's for their independent living homes that they have throughout Orange County. And so I had the opportunity to gather a group of people together, adopt a home. At the time, there were about 10 people, and that was back in probably 2001, 2003, early 2000s. And what we do is we get together, we throw a party for the high-functioning disabled people that hold down jobs, lead independent lives, and there is like a house mom, for lack of a better word, that looks over and just makes sure that everything's running smoothly. And so I get a group together to decorate the home, donate all the gifts on the residents' wish lists, and then the volunteers and everybody get to enjoy a nice holiday party and dinner that night as well. We started with one home, and now we've got three that we adopt. So it started with 10 residents, and now we've got almost 30, and I have about 50 volunteers that go out every year, and it's been, yeah, like almost 15 years or so, give or take, that we've been doing this.
Sounds like you've got a growing army of folks helping you out with this.
Yeah, it's great. I have a team that, you know, helps me every year. It's the same people, and then usually a lot of the time it's the same people that come out and donate and want to be a part of it, and you know, churches have been involved before and donated their time and efforts too. So yeah, it just keeps growing each year. And then I just keep adopting more homes that maybe other people have not adopted.
So let me ask you then what it was that made you want to get involved with this particular cause, the folks who are in these independent living homes, independent living situations?
Well, I think it kind of breaks my heart that sometimes people are forgotten at the holidays. And a lot of the disabled people that live in the independent living homes might not have any family that are still alive, or maybe they're out of state, or maybe they just don't have anybody. So that kind of spurred it on for me. And I think getting involved with Quest, I always kind of wondered, you know, if you're a parent of a disabled child, as they get older, if you pass on or something happens, wouldn't you worry about your child? And Quest does a really good job of really taking care of people, helping them to achieve their goals and advance their skill sets so they can take care of themselves and be part of the community. So I just always admired that. And it's just kind of funny how you get involved in things. And I've always been volunteering since I was a kid. This was just something that my husband actually suggested this organization to me before he was my husband. So it's just kind of funny how it all came together.
Well, let me bring you into the conversation, Avni. This is what you're focused on, right? You're trying to foster a sense of kind of charity in your children. Explain how that came about and what you do.
Sure. I've made it probably the last 2 years focusing on something we call family philanthropy. And something I learned from the Central Florida Foundation is, before, my husband would have things that he would want to focus on from a philanthropic perspective. I would have things I want to focus on, and then my children would just do what we tell them that they had to do. And then the last year, what we did was we actually sat around and said, what do we want to do as a family? And, you know, as a parent, a teacher, a role model, you don't have to be elaborate when it comes to getting your children involved in philanthropy. You know, sometimes it's the simplest things that are as mostly profound. So one thing that we do as a family is my children save. So they have their piggy bank, and then they also have a piggy bank for others. And that piggy bank gets the same amount of money, or, you know, however the children want to do it. And at the end of the year, when we're focusing on what we're going to give back to, they have a pot of money that they can do what they want to do from that. You know, the other things that we focus on is, you know, we do volunteer trips to the soup kitchen. We go to Arnold Palmer Medical Center. I'm on the board there, and we do events there, and we take the children there. We just did a trick-or-treating event there. Mm-hmm. And also, as a mom and a caregiver, I focus on, you know, when I decide of what we're going to do on our summer camps or after-school activities, finding areas that also focus on philanthropy and volunteerism so I can surround my children with a positive role model and also like-minded people.
How do you come up with, or how do your kids come up with the charity that they want to contribute to? Yeah. Is it like a sit down at the table, discuss it as a family, or do they just sort of come to you and say, I like this charity, we're going to give our piggy bank money to this, and there's no discussion, that's it?
No, we do sit down. So we just sat down last weekend of what we wanted to focus on. And my son decided he wanted to focus on Arnold Palmer Medical Center and go to the outpatient oncology and give all the children who are there during the holiday time emoji balls. And my daughter said she wanted to do the same thing, but give them hugs. And I think both of their decisions made me happy as a mom. You know, one was giving something. The other one was maybe giving back spiritually, right? But the other thing is, you know, I think giving back, teaching children to give back does three things. You know, one, it cultivates awareness, empathy, and gratitude. You know, exposing my children to hardships of people in the community, it does increase how they are more empathetic. And I hope that they become empathetic adults. I always say I want myself and my children to leave the world a little better than we came into it. And I think empathy has a huge component to it. And I also think it provides them self-confidence. Can you imagine telling a child that you can change a life of somebody? And I tell my children that, and my son thinks he's like a superhero. Mm-hmm. So, you know, volunteering and acts of kindness, I think, provide self-confidence. And at the end of the day, it makes them good citizens and it makes them better human beings. So if I can instill those three things through, you know, volunteerism and philanthropy, I think I've been a success from a parent.
Beth, I see you nodding your head as you're listening there. And, you know, think back to when you were a kid and you sort of first made a step towards that kind of charitable mindset. What was it that made you want to give back?
Yeah, I mean, my mom had always given her time to organizations and hospitals and nursing homes. And so I grew up being a part of that. And I think that really was a very strong foundation for me. So when I moved to Orlando, I was looking for opportunities and I was just saying, well, where can I go and volunteer and give back? And that's when my husband, Jim, mentioned Quest. And I've been involved ever since 2001. So I think to your point, I think it's really important to start, you know, to get kids involved at a young age. And I do think it's such a positive force that it really changed my life. And that's, it's a big part of my life, you know, to this day and probably will be forever.
Now, when you think about the team of volunteers you have, what's the youngest volunteer you have?
Oh, gosh. People bring their kids all the time. So you've got little kids. I mean, it doesn't even matter. We just say, bring your kids, bring your family. So 4-year-olds to teenagers. I mean, everybody is welcome. And I think that's what makes this Adopt-A-Home event so unique. I think it's great that there are three ways that you can help. You can donate your time, your money to Quest, where we can buy the gifts for the residents for you. You can donate decorations, food. You can show up and enjoy the party and bring gifts. I mean, there's so many ways that you can help. And then, you know, like I said, you can volunteer your time, bring your kids and show them how they can have direct impact. And that was one of the words that you had brought up that I thought, that's exactly what you can see. You can see your direct impact of making people feel special.
Avni, Giving Tuesday gives people an opportunity to kind of focus on charitable giving and volunteerism. But it sounds like for you, it's not just a one and done thing. You're trying to keep this going throughout the year. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think children are innately giving. It's a skill that you got to keep on cultivating so adults become innately giving. For us, it's the same thing. You know, if we're volunteering somewhere, I take my children with me. I'm a co-chair of 100 Women Strong, which is a giving circle under the Central Florida Foundation. And when we have Good Work Socials, if I have it at my house, I have my children come. You know, like I said, we recently packed Halloween bags for the children who couldn't leave the hospital. And my children went shopping with me to buy bags and they invited their friends. I invited the moms and the dads who wanted to join us to pack. And just having awareness, I think, is the most important thing that we can do to instill philanthropy and volunteerism in children. And they get excited. Like I said, if they can make an impact, and there's actually medical studies that say oxytocin is released when children feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. And that happens when they volunteer, because at the end they can see the product of what they were able to do.
Mm-hmm. You kind of get a buzz when you
get a buzz. Do something charitable. You give a giving buzz. And the other thing I like to do is to take them. So I took them to the hospital so they were able to see the excitement on the children's face. And that's full circle that, you know, they saw from buying the items, putting them together and seeing how happy the children were, that now my son says, oh, I definitely want to do that again next year. The other thing that we recently did was part of 100 Women Strong is we have taken two daycares and doing a pilot study. But one thing I've decided to do is take my son to read to the children. And he's six, so he doesn't read too well, but he can read to the children. And when we left, they all gave him a hug, and he was just so excited about it. And he talks about it every day since we left of, when can I go back? Can I buy books for them? So if you just show awareness and show them the good that they can do in the world, I think you've instilled volunteerism in them, and it becomes a lifelong skill.
Beth Hobart, what do you think about when you think about Giving Tuesday? Does it seem like an antidote to the consumerism that we sort of embark on in the lead up to Christmas time?
I think so. I think it just gives you that warm and fuzzy where you just have a day where let's focus on giving back to our community, the organizations that make a difference. Especially, I learned a fact recently that people in Orlando, we actually donate outside of the community rather than here, because most of us are from other places, went to college in other places. So I would love to see, you know, more people donate locally to the organizations that we have here, because there's so many wonderful organizations that we should support.
What are some of your tips for people who want to get involved in some volunteerism or some charitable giving over the holidays?
Oh, gosh, there's so many opportunities. Obviously, Quest is my biggest, my most favorite. And I find it interesting, too, that a lot of people just always say, thank you for the opportunity to let me know how I can give back. So I think a lot of times just getting the word out, if you're having an event, just getting the word out and giving that people that opportunity. I'm always kind of tuned in to events and things going on with nonprofits locally.
How do you find out about them? Is it social media? Is that the way?
A lot of times social media. I mean, even with Quest, you know, we always put on Facebook our events, and then just from past people that were involved. So we just send it out to the same people that always help and let them know.
Avni Desai, what would be some of your words of advice to parents looking to get their kids involved, or just people who want to get involved themselves in volunteerism?
I think a great resource is the Central Florida Foundation. They have a website where you could look up all local non-for-profits. And for a person that comes from the finance world, you can actually look up how well they do financially. And
So you would say do your homework
do
before
your homework.
You,
yes,
before you give.
You do. And also sit down and see what you're passionate about. And sometimes, as a family, if you sit down, you'll start to realize that you all are passionate about very similar things or things that are interconnected. But the words of advice that I could give a parent is, you know, you're investing in your child's character, direction, and future, which also you're investing in the world. So just know that these small things can make such a large impact to this part of our map that we live in.
Well, Avni Desai is an IT executive. She works to build a sense of generosity in her own children by involving them in volunteering and charitable causes. Thank you so much, Avni.
Thank you.
Also joined by Beth Hobart. She's a realtor, and she runs the Quest Adopt a Home holiday party. Beth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you can find links with more details about the Adopt a Home holiday party and the Central Florida Foundation over on our website, wmfe.org. Up next. Cats are talking to each other.
Yes, so we had a disagreement up front with a couple of tigers, and tigers disagree by barking at each other, and lions respond to sounds in the distance by responding with their own pride numbers.
A visit to a big cat sanctuary. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. How do you talk to a big cat? Do lions know how to count? And can you really tame a tiger? Dr. K. Simba Wiltz has been figuring out the answers to these questions for about 16 years. He's the CEO and Senior Vice President at the Central Florida Animal Reserve, a big cat sanctuary in the heart of Osceola County. When we meet at the reserve, he's dressed in khakis and a hat, a two-way radio clipped to his belt. Through the mist rising off the ground, you can see tigers roaming inside their enclosures. There are 22 big cats at the reserve, which opened to the public just a couple weeks ago.
Likely we'll get some tiger language here. Hi, Charger. So that noise that you're hearing is formerly known as Preston. We just call it a chuff. The tiger that we're talking to is Charger. So we're probably about 3 feet away from a 400-pound Bengal tiger. He's standing, roughly about 2.5 feet at the shoulder. Although if he were to stand on his hind legs, he would reach probably about 8 feet into the air, well over the height of a human.
It's kind of like making purring noises, like a domestic cat almost.
Almost, although this is a unique sound. Only tigers make this sound. And they only use this sound usually in a greeting. So that's a hello. But they use the chuff in the same way that we use the word love, whereby you can love somebody, you can love pizza, you can love the way people drive, depending on the context. And this, in this case, is very much a hello. He has been one that I've been around for the entirety of his life, and he recognizes me, of course, but also many of the other volunteers who have been around him throughout the course of his life. That's the one thing that really becomes special about working with them, is that they do have a recognition of those that care for them.
And where did this fella come from?
Charger was actually born in the organization that predated us, and he was actually a breech birth, which was a rather interesting day. The mother was having problems getting the cub out of the birth canal, and so she allowed us to assist with this birth, hand assist an unsedated tigress with the birth of a breech birth cub. It was a rather special moment.
Now, this other tiger that's wandering over is a different breed of tiger?
Yes. This is Masunkala. He is... hi, buddy. This is... Masunkala is a Siberian tiger. And Siberian tigers are larger than the Bengal tigers. And so Masunkala is about 3 feet at the shoulder. And when he lifts his head up, he's... The tip of his nose actually reaches a little over 4 feet. So if you're 5 feet tall or otherwise, then he's basically looking you straight in the eye.
Wow. When you greet these tigers every morning, what goes through your mind? Because they're, you know, they're magnificent creatures, they seem pretty friendly, but these are big, strong, wild animals, right? So what, you know, what's going through your mind as you greet them in the morning?
Well, the first thing that you have to do is know that you have to respect the tiger. It's been a long time of establishing relationship with them, and each one of them is different. They all address the world in different ways. For me, I've been doing this with this population for almost 16, 17 years now, and so my greeting of the cats has kind of got a very different purpose. It's never just a hello. Everything is an examination. What is their attitude and spirit? What is their injury status? Is there any change from the last time that I greeted them? All of that becomes important because they are such tough creatures. They don't tell you often what's going on with them. So you have to use a lot of deductive clinical reasoning to figure out whether or not everything is okay. And it's also, of course, an honor. You can't force a cat to like you. You have to let them choose their people. And just as there are cats that certainly prefer others, it's always great to feel like they prefer you.
So there are some similarities in big cat behavior and domestic cat behavior.
Absolutely. The thing is that people like to try and make comparisons between big cats and small cats. And from a behavioral standpoint, it often can look very similar. But from there, it starts to become a lot deeper. Each cat brings its own personality and culture, but they also bring the natural tools, talents, and predilections to act on those personalities. And that's where things get fun. So now we're meeting Joaquin, another big white tiger, but he's a really big guy. And you can almost hear it in his chuff. He's got a wonderful chuff. But even laying here, he is just his body length is about 6 feet or so.
So he's a bit bigger than some of the other animals we've just taken a look at.
Yes, indeed. So he is probably around 500 pounds, probably in excess. And when he stands up and he puts his head up, his nose is definitely about at the 5 foot level. So he's one that will look you in the eye, absolutely, when he decides he likes to get up. This is kind of also an interesting view of the differences in size. You know, Joaquin, here he's getting up. Joaquin is one of our biggest tigers, who is paired with one of our smallest. And they come in all different sizes. So Honey, the little one up there, she's might be 300 pounds.
She's kind of petite compared to this guy.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, she's the older of the two. Even though this guy and she did not grow up together. They were peer grouped at a later time based upon personality and the need for companionship. And even though they don't breed, they do need to have others that they're with because it helps stabilize their psychological state and gives them the chance to have the physical affection that they can from a species that can actually handle it.
In another enclosure, we meet a lion named Cola. The cats are talking to each other.
Yes, so we had a disagreement up front with a couple of tigers, and tigers disagree by barking at each other, and lions respond to sounds in the distance by responding with their own pride numbers. And so this was kind of a call and response between species.
So they were checking off.
Pretty much. And lions can count. This has been proven in the wild. And if you think about it, a huge survival skill. If you are a rival pride and you're miles away and you hear a pride sounding, you're going to want to know how many lions that is to know whether to run or whether to stand your ground.
Towards the back of the sanctuary are two of the chattiest big cats, a couple of Siberian tigers called Angel and Gabriel.
Where's Gabriel? There he is. Yes. So the thing that I had mentioned before is that not all cats like people. And so it becomes very important for us to provide safety and shelter for those cats that are a little bit more nervous and hesitant around people. And these two are definitely ones, very loving, but they don't like to see a whole bunch of strangers, so they get to be in the luxury suites back here. Full service without all of the attention of the general public. Got a kiss for me, Gabriel? Hear the sound of what it sounds like to get licked by a tiger. Yeah. Thank you for the kisses. They've got extremely, extremely rough tongues, so even though it sounds and like a fantasy to be able to be kissed by a tiger, it's really a lot like being abraded by wet sandpaper, heavily gritted.
What got you interested in working with big cats in the first place?
I've always had an interest in big cats, even from young. The initial thing that got me interested was when there was a canine distemper outbreak in Kenya around 94. That actually led me to learn a lot about lions and disease vectors and really about their society. It led me into my professional career. I am trained as a pharmacist, but have actually made part of my career learning about the big cats and have gone hands-on in 2001 and have been doing it ever since.
So this location is quite new. It's bigger than what you had before. Just explain the shift from Cocoa, where you were before, to where we are now in St. Cloud.
In order to really reach our educational goals, we had to expand. These cats have a tremendous value to society. They have a tremendous educational value as well as a social value, and we were not able to accomplish it there. That combined with the issues with the Brevard Board of County Commissioners, where we had to move, it really all added up to having to find a place that we could build something that was going to be more akin to what we were trying to get for the cats.
So you had more buy-in from the local government here?
Osceola County is a very agriculturally friendly community, and the local community has been great in terms of embracing us, and it also eliminates the issues of neighbors or other people who may not actually want to be around the cats. It's kind of the balance that we have to strike in order to have them exist within a human society.
So you've got a bunch of enclosures. They're essentially like sort of large open-sided barns with some wire, obviously, so the cats can't get out and people can walk around and see these cats?
Yes, so we do guided tours, and part of the reason we keep them guided is it enables us to tell the stories of the cats and really emphasize the educational value of it. Seeing the cats by themselves is neat, but when someone who understands and is highly educated about them can point out small details, it really brings the reality of their existence home, and that's what we want people to take away from it.
How many cats do you have here?
We have 22 cats currently.
And how much does it cost to run a place like this?
We cost about $15,000 a month, and it's a very expensive venture. Because they have a lot of special needs. Our population is older, so veterinary care is highly specialized and often necessary. So we exist entirely off of philanthropy from private individuals. There is no state or federal funding that supports this kind of work.
22 big cats. I imagine the bill for food is a significant portion of that tally you mentioned, the $15,000 a month. How much does it cost to keep these cats fed?
Well, keeping in mind that they can only eat meat, so that means chicken, beef, pork, horse meat, if it is available, we're talking about anywhere from $4,000 to $6,000 a month. And in the winter months, when they eat more, it can be more than that. So that by itself is our single biggest expense, followed, of course, by the maintenance and utilities for this location.
How does the Central Florida Animal Reserve fit into the broader network of zoos across America?
Well, we would be considered a wildlife sanctuary. We don't do any breeding. None of the cats are sold here, and they stay here for the duration of their lives. Our role is to be part of the social safety net that just doesn't exist for big cats. When cats are in need, or if there are other organizations that are not able to make it financially, these animals have no home, and the zoos, unfortunately, can't take them because it's not part of their particular programs. So it's up to us as private individuals and nonprofit entities to make sure that they have a home and to provide them the care that they need.
So some of the animals you might have here, or the animals that might come to this operation, they would be domesticated animals, former pets? Would they be part of other kind of exhibits that have closed down?
Yeah, big cats are never domesticated, and they always have their wild instincts. They come from all kinds of backgrounds. We've got cats that were confiscations due to law enforcement actions, and they needed a home, and that was us. Cats that had been in the pet industry, and once they're no longer suitable for someone thinking they can control them, then they come to us. We've had cats that have been part of breeding operations, cats that have come from as far north and west as Oregon, really from all over the place. And it is a labor of love for the volunteers here who spend their time and energy to make this actually work.
And how many folks do you have running the place?
We have multiple cores, so there are about 10 people who really spend significant time and energy, full-time kind of time and energy on this work, in spite of having full-time jobs already. And then there's a halo of another probably 30 or 40 people who come and do labor out here, help feed the cats, do maintenance. But we're always looking for more. We're looking for people who can help us really take the next step in this organization's evolution.
Are you worried about continued funding for the place? And I know you've only just opened to the public, but do you look at the $15,000 a month bill and think, how am I going to keep this going?
Every day. Sometimes hourly to hourly. You know, because there aren't those state and federal funds and whatnot, we have to be able to convince people that their time, their energy, their treasure is worth investing in this. And as I've always told people, when they actually encounter a big cat, they're changed. They see the world a little bit different. And, you know, it's the giving season right now, and so the holiday season is huge for us in terms of being able to make it not just this month, but in the future months. It really is about legacy. And for everyone who would be listening now, they have to ask themselves, if you were looking at future generations, what would you want them to see to let them know what you found valuable today? And just as I would imagine that a portion of them should be donating to their public radio station, they should also be saying, you know, our natural world matters, and I want my kids and grandkids to know what it is to stand 4 feet away from a tiger.
Okay, so is this it as far as the size of the place? Are you looking to expand further?
Our expansion is going to really depend on the needs of the cats and the challenges that we face. Our mission has always been to create a platform that will address the challenges of big cats in the future, but provide value to society today. And in order to address those challenges, we will have to expand the operations. We want to gain enough support to put in a truly world-class visitor center so people can come and learn in an indoor environment, but also a customized veterinary center so we can address the unique medical concerns that come with these guys.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that a lot of the folks who work there here, they're donating their time and effort, but this is your full-time gig, right?
No, it actually isn't.
It's not.
although it is and it isn't. So I really kind of have it as two full-time gigs. In addition to practicing pharmacy, I do also manage a lot of the business elements for this organization and the animal care program. The resources go to the cats, so I don't draw a salary from this. In fact, none of the people who are running the organization draw a salary from this. And that, in some ways, is an amazing story in itself. This is a collection of ordinary people who have come together for an extraordinary task, to take these cats and to be their shield in a world that may not necessarily understand them and bring that world in so that they can gain an appreciation for their conservation.
Dr. Simba Wiltz is the CEO of the Central Florida Animal Reserve. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for coming.
And you can find more details about the Central Florida Animal Reserve on our website, WMFE.org. Still to come on Intersection.
They let me bring my dog in. I read next to the Slurpee machine. People came in and bought lottery tickets while I was reading from it. And then afterwards, I signed copies of the book and like next to the hot dog roller, and like people bought chips and stuff. And it was fun. It was exactly what I wanted, which is what I think maybe your book launch should be. It should be like the thing that you want to have. You know, if you're having like a wedding, it should be the thing that you want. This was my 7-Eleven marriage to my first book.
Kristen Arnett's writing as part of a new collection from Burrow Press. Arnett joins us along with publisher Ryan Revis and Orlando's poet laureate Susan Lilly for a conversation about the creativity blooming in Central Florida's literary scene. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Burrow Press has a new book out. It's a collection of short stories and essays from current and former Floridians. It's called We Can't Help It If We're From Florida, New Stories from a Sinking Peninsula. It's Burrow Press's biggest book yet. Joining me to tell us more about it is publisher Ryan Revis. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined by Kristen Arnett. Her collection of short stories, Felt in the Jaw, was published in September. Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
And Susan Lilly, published in the American Poetry Review, Gulf Coast, the Florida Review, and other journals. She's also Orlando's first poet laureate. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you for having us.
Ryan, I want to start with you. What makes this collection special?
What makes it special is that we pulled together some really exciting writers who are publishing contemporary literary fiction and creative nonfiction, like at the moment. Mm-hmm. So Kristen, among many others, has a new novel out or new short story collections. And it's, although not all the authors live here anymore, it's kind of a showcase of the talent that we have. And that kind of ties into the name. We Can't Help It If We're From Florida is named after an old punk rock album from the 80s. It was a compilation of different Florida bands and record labels. And this is sort of a similar bringing together of talent to show off what we have in terms of Florida writers and writing about Florida.
Is there a bit of a punk spirit to the writing therein as well?
A little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. For instance, the preface is really a fiction piece by way of preface, and it's titled What is Florida Literature? And I don't think that question is really answered.
Kristen, you've written a little bit about kind of what makes Florida special and what you like or dislike, or just kind of your feelings on what it's like to be a writer in Florida. Just go through some of the things that kind of stand out for you. I mean, pub subs are one of them, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. The other day I was shopping for Thanksgiving food and ate one as I was shopping in the store and felt supremely Floridian as I did that. I talk a lot about place because I think that that's something I like to write about, but also like home, which I think is very important. And for me, home is Florida. I've only lived here. I haven't ever lived anywhere else. I think the furthest I've ever lived is Gainesville. Mm-hmm. But writing about Florida is like, so I wrote that essay about like things I find problematic about people's writing about Florida, right? The idea of like the Florida man, or this kind of mm-hmm. idea that, you know, Florida is this wasteland where mutants live that can't live anywhere else, crawling out of the swamp, what have you. But the thing that I was trying to dig at about writing about Florida is that it's so myriad. There's so many different, first of all, parts of Florida or spaces in Florida that it's like you can't write about Florida. Or maybe it's just that people are trying to dig at something, trying to get at the heart of what home is. And for me, that's writing about Florida. But then I was like, okay, well, how do I write about it? And I still don't know. Mm-hmm. So maybe that is the longish answer to that is I have no idea.
Well, Susan, do you have trouble formulating your thoughts about Florida in poetry?
No, because like Kristen, I was born and raised here. I don't have the Southern accents. My parents did. They were born and raised here, too. I blame television, a life of television education for destroying my Southern accent. But I'm fascinated by Florida, and I write a lot of celebration-type poems about Florida that are very exuberant and full of Florida imagery. And sometimes it's a little too bright and shiny, and then I overreact the other direction. And I have a whole poem about a tree that is only exists as far north as some of the Keys that mm-hmm. is, I think it's called a Spanish merchant apple. And I don't know, I'll have to find out. But this tree was used by the Calusa Indians to kill people because it's so acidic and poisonous that you could tie someone to it and the tree would like slowly eat through their clothes and finally get to their skin and their entire being would be consumed, but it took a long time. I'm obsessed with that tree, and I really hope it still exists. There's no animals will eat off of it. It's very biblical when you think about it. It's like, do not eat of this tree. They all know it. Mm-hmm. But humans, they're the ones that die by the tree. So things like that, things like the gators, the everything, and in fact, in Kristen's beautiful essay about the trouble with writing about Florida, we all live with those. And it's almost like the wildness of Florida is really just under the surface of the concrete. It's always here. Mm-hmm. It's always with us. And I think those of us who were raised here have a much bigger sense of that than transplants do.
And I should point out, too, that the essay we're referring to is was published in Literary Hub recently. Ryan, just come back to you for a moment. Do you think Florida writers, can they be a little bit defensive about their state?
I guess it depends. I don't know if a Florida writer wants to necessarily be pigeonholed into that, especially a literary writer, into that label. But I think you can sense when you're reading fiction or creative nonfiction about Florida, or poetry even, you can sense in the writer's efforts that they're trying to sort of show something that you think you know but you don't as a reader. Or show something that we all think we know in a different light. So it kind of tears down the cliches and stereotypes that are so often associated with Florida.
Okay, so tell me about some of the other writers who are published in this latest book. Who else have you gotten there?
Yeah, so Lydia Yuknovich, who's an amazing writer. She has a new book out called The Misfit Manifesto. She is one of the writers in the collection who's probably never coming back to Florida, but she writes in the book about her experience first moving to Gainesville for a new job that her father got, and about how she was training to be this professional swimmer. And it kind of ties into one of her earlier memoirs. And that's a really beautiful piece. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's Jason Ockert's story, which is simply a man laying on a beach when an anole climbs on his, chest. And he's thinking about his ex-girlfriend and this possible sand monster that kind of appears before him. And so it goes from sort of the gritty realism of high school to like the fabulism of what it is to be on this random desolate beach on the coast somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a wide variety of stories.
Kristen, speaking of realism, I want to ask you about the literary launch for your collection of stories, Felt in the Jaw. You were going to have this in a 7-Eleven, is that right? Did that actually happen? Because I know that was around the time of the hurricane.
Yeah, it did happen. It was extremely fun. Well, what had occurred was I was thinking a lot about, I've been having this collection put together, and I knew I needed to do some kind of event for it. And thinking about having an event made me exhausted. And I was also thinking about, well, I'd really like to do it in some place I feel comfortable, some place that feels like home. And what place feels like home to me? And I was like, oh, 7-Eleven. I'm there like every day. Like I know the cashier by name. We hang out all the time, kind of jokingly refer to it as my neighborhood bar. Mm-hmm. So I just went in and I was like, hey, do you guys care if I like had a bunch of people in here and I read some of the book? And they were like, yeah, we don't care. So I was like, great. So I happened to be like talking about it on Twitter And what happened is the guy that runs the book reviews for the New York Times contacted me and was like, hey, are you really going to do this? Can I interview you about this? Ask some questions. I was like, okay, sure. So it ended up being this whole big thing. But yeah, we planned it for like, it was like that weekend right after the hurricane. They let me bring my dog in. I read next to the Slurpee machine. People came in and bought lottery tickets while I was reading from it. And then afterwards, I signed copies of the book and like next to the hot dog roller and like people bought chips and stuff. And it was fun. It was exactly what I wanted, which is what I think maybe your book launch should be. It should be like the thing that you want to have. You know, if you're having like a wedding, it should be the thing that you want. This was my 7-Eleven marriage to my first book.
Because when you think of a book launch, normally you think about something that's a little more choreographed, I guess, or a little more formal.
Mm-hmm.
Are other authors doing similar things, just sort of finding a place they love and holding it there?
Yeah, I've had some conversations with people afterward just because I feel like it really resonated, that idea of like having it be in this like less formal space or being a thing that you would want to do. Like I know Dan Hoyt just had a book published and he was like, I'm going to do it in my favorite bar. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Also, I was talking to Tony Perez, who's like an editor over at Tin House, and he was like, oh, and he's married to Karen Russell, who did a thing for the book.
Vampires and the Lemon Grab, right?
Yeah, Swamplandia.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, Karen was so jealous of your 7-Eleven book launch that she wants to do something like that, too. And I was like, that rules, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of it being like, because I don't think things have to necessarily be formal or like really, you know, put together in this kind of way to be good. It just has to be a thing you really want to do. And that's really what I wanted to do. So,
are you a Slurpee fanatic?
Yes, I had one yesterday, actually.
What's your favorite flavor?
Coke and cherry, mix them together, and that's the best flavor.
Classic.
Yeah.
Well, just on that theme of making art and literature accessible, Susan Lilly, is that part of your job as Orlando's first poet laureate?
Yes. My job is to change the face of Central Florida with poetry. But I am really excited that Orlando, specifically through Mayor Dyer, had the good idea to establish a poet laureateship, I guess the noun is, because of the arts, poetry is sometimes the most misunderstood, overlooked, difficult to face, especially I teach, you know, seniors in high school, so I know how difficult it is for them sometimes. And I really would like to give more people the chance to write. I think writing, as William Stafford said, is one of the great free human activities. You don't need to buy a lot of equipment. There are so many stories to be told in this city, in greater Orlando. So I feel like I'm an advocate, not so much for poetry alone, but also any kind of creative writing. Plus, our literary community is burgeoning, and maybe it's because of the fecund, fabulous Florida atmosphere, but it is really becoming something on a much grander scale than I ever experienced growing up here. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it has to do with people like Ryan Rivas, to my right, but people bringing a lot of energy to the literary scene. So I would like to also, for whatever I can do in my position, to shine more light on the great literary talent we have here.
Do you have to write a certain number of poems, or are there certain events that you're going to be called upon to write a poem for?
Yes, I'm going to have a few assignments, which as a teacher fills me with dread. I already wrote one poem that I was very happy about, and it just sort of sprang forth about seasons in Florida. But I don't know if that's going to happen the other three times that I have to write them. So anytime I think about I have a good poem about Orlando that is not entirely full of like bad behavior or someone dying or, you know, I'm going to just quickly write it and then hold it, and I'm just going to have it in the can, you know, for when I'm ready. Mm-hmm. No, I'm really happy to serve in all ways in this role, especially working with school children. I'm in the planning stages of doing something in all six districts. But writing something for an occasion is something I don't know what that's going to be like. So we shall see.
Ryan Rivas, does this feel like a sort of a celebration of Florida, or is it a little more complex than that, the We Can't Help It If We're From Florida collection?
I think it's a celebration, and in true Florida spirit, I think it's a tongue-in-cheek celebration. I mean, the title is ironic. Like, we understand that this is a weird place to live, we understand that it's unique, but also when you do think about Florida books, You shouldn't just think about like the hard-boiled crime fiction and like the wacky ripped from the headlines comedies. There are other writers here. They're doing serious work, even if that work is serious and weird or and funny or whatever it is. So we're trying to bring all those elements together in the book. And it's kind of like having your reading in a 7-Eleven. It's like you can go anywhere in Florida, any restaurant, almost any restaurant, and wear flip-flops and shorts, right? Like it's not a very, it's a casual place. Mm-hmm. It's not a very formal place. So combining the elements of serious literature with the playfulness and weirdness and even to a certain degree tackiness of Florida is kind of what this book is all about. And also just happens to be sort of like my personal preference and mode.
And it's the biggest book you've put out as well? You're getting more ambitious as publisher of Burrow Press?
I think big in terms of we were able to wrangle all these amazing writers who are big in other respects and successful in their field, as well as some really interesting emerging writers, and put it out into the world. So a lot of people know the writers who are in the book, and hopefully by putting them all in one package, they'll think a little bit more about Florida as a whole and, you know, maybe develop some tastes and thoughtful criticisms of good and bad Florida writing and what that means.
You talked about the fact that there are writers who've been there all their lives. They've sort of grown up in the literary scene here. There are some who've come here recently. Are there some who sort of boomerang back, like they leave for greener pastures and then realize that Florida is where they need to be?
I think so. I can't think off the top of my head if anyone from the book has done that. But in general, I know plenty of people who they go out to another literary community in New York or Portland or L.A. and it's just different. And sometimes the swamp calls them back. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not sure if it's mentioned in her essay, but Jakira Diaz is a Miami born and raised. And she's left the state several times. She's currently still not in the state. But we always talk about how Miami kind of calls you back. Like you just can't escape it. It's always inside you. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a real thing, a real phenomenon.
There is a book launch coming up on the 29th.
Mm-hmm. So as with all things, like I just said, it's a mix of a serious reading. It'll feature Kristen, Lindsay Hunter, visiting from Chicago, back in her hometown. So Rob Frasis, who lives in Jacksonville, Raquel Henry, who's another local, and Shane Hinton, the editor, who is a seventh-generation strawberry farmer from Plant City. So they'll be doing some readings from the book, which is like, what can you say? It's a literary reading, and it's going to be excellent. But that's all happening within the context of Florida Casual, which includes a shuffleboard. Our friends at the Orlando Shuffle, who run that every like second and third Saturday or something, there is a legit Orlando shuffleboard community. They will be there helping you learn how to play. And of course, inspired by Kristen, there will be Slurpees. I think we spell that with a Z to avoid licensing issues. There will be pub subs from Publix and all kinds of irreverence, some weird Florida visuals and sounds, and it'll be a party. And I think that's important. Because literature with a capital L can sometimes seem so off-putting or pretentious or elitist. And in my experience and knowing a lot of writers, it's not like that at all. So we're trying to put some fun into it as well.
Ryan Rivas is the publisher of Burrow Press. The new book is called We Can't Help It If We're From Florida. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Susan Lilly, Orlando's new poet laureate. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
And Kristen Arnett, author of Felt in the Jaw. Kristen, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Alana Campbell. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. And while you're there, consider making a contribution to our silent drive. We're in the home stretch, and we do rely on your support to make local programs like Intersection. Thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Petty.